I'm Heather Vail, and this is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Joining me is Arash Ghafoori, CEO of the Nevada Partnership for Homeless Youth, or NPHY, and Melissa Jacobowitz, Chief of Development and Strategy for NPHY. The organization recently received an $800,000 federal grant from the Department of Housing and Urban Development, or HUD, which allows them to do even more to support homeless youth in our community. Arash and Melissa, thank you both so much for being here today.
Thank you for having us, Heather.
Absolutely. Thank you.
So for those who aren't familiar, what exactly is NPHY?
Nevada Partnership for Homeless Youth, or NPHY, is the most comprehensive service provider here in Nevada for young people experiencing homelessness. So that means we really do everything and anything that we can to meet young people's immediate needs, get them out of survival mode, and provide them with the tools, the resources, and the support to get them off the streets for good and on a pathway to long-term self-sufficiency and success. So we provide a lot of comprehensive, wraparound, and holistic supportive services to meet individual young people's needs. However, in doing this work over time, we've discovered that, of course, meeting individual young people's needs is so essential and so critically important to solving youth homelessness here in Nevada. But we've also realized over time that if we want to really make a long-term dent in this issue and really move the needle, that we also have to do work that's beyond the individual level and is looking more at the systems level environment and ecosystem that our young people are in, breaking down barriers and really preventing young people from experiencing homelessness in the first place, and creating a community and a state where young people can exit homelessness for good and have those resources that they need to be able to stay housed and accomplish their dreams. So NPHY does a lot of different things on both of those levels and many different levels to fight youth homelessness here in our community.
Okay. And when was NPHY established?
NPHY was established in 2000, and in 2001, we really hit the ground running with a changing state policy, as well as opening our first ever drop-in center to be able to serve young people experiencing homelessness for the first time.
What is the current state of youth homelessness in Nevada?
Youth homelessness is a crisis in Nevada, and unfortunately, it continues to be a growing crisis in Nevada. According to HUD, the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, the number of unaccompanied young people, so young people experiencing homelessness on their own, disconnected from their families, actually increased 14% from 2022 to 2023. And across our state here in Nevada, we had over 16,000 students identified in school districts throughout Nevada as experiencing homelessness. And we know that that's a severe undercount. We know there are many more young people falling through the cracks and not being seen by those in this count. And, you know, it really is a major, major issue here in Nevada. In Nevada, we also have the most severe shortage of affordable housing in the country for extremely low income renters. So it's very, very difficult for young people or any person to really kind of claw their way out of homelessness in the current experience of our state.
And Heather, I would add for the listeners that not only is it just that the numbers, we have some of the highest incidences of youth homelessness in the country, and it's been that way for a very long time. But it's not only just the numbers, but it's also what those numbers represent in terms of what Melissa was just talking about. It's a very daunting proposition for any young person experiencing homelessness to graduate from any program into our local climate right now, where unemployment is among the highest in the nation, where affordable housing is critically lacking in our community, where education may not be as easily accessible because of other barriers. So not only is this a problem because of the numbers of young people experiencing homelessness, and not only is it a problem because we don't have enough beds and accompanied critical resources that young people need to get out of homelessness, but on top of that, young people also have to graduate into a situation where there's a lot of uncertainty into what their labor opportunities look like, what their education opportunities look like, and what the housing opportunities look like. And when we think about things like rent almost doubling in Southern Nevada over a two-year period, but wages have not, this creates a daunting proposition for many members of our community, but especially for young people experiencing homelessness.
Mm-hmm. So then tell us about the significance of the $800,000 HUD grant that you were recently awarded for youth homelessness system improvement.
Yes, we call it the YESI grant. And the YESI grants are really incredible opportunities. So the Department of Housing and Urban Development, they traditionally only fund direct service beds, meaning that they want to fund communities to have beds for people who are experiencing homelessness to get out of those situations. And that's really where their focus has been. But they're acknowledging now that beds have to be coordinated. It's like a hospital system. We may have beds laying out throughout our city, but unless we coordinate with each other, talk with each other, young people are going going to fall through the cracks. Services may not be as optimal as they need to be. And HUD is acknowledging that we need to take a look at the system that is serving the youth and not just necessarily adding more things to the system without thinking about how they work together and are they balanced and are they actually effective for young people. Therefore, HUD put out this announcement and this opportunity, I believe around $50 million nationwide. And it is significant that Nevada and MPHY applying on behalf of the entire state was able to secure these resources. It was a very competitive funding where we were competing against state governments, local governments in other states, big foundations, and even some other private groups too. So there was a lot of competition for this money, but Nevada really needed this systems level investment because what this is really going to allow us to do, and we'll talk about that more in a minute, but it's so significant also because Nevada has not had a great track record of attracting enough federal dollars to our community. And we at MPHY over the years have been trying to work harder at getting more federal dollars into our community to combat the issue of youth homelessness. And we're really happy to report that this is one of the biggest infusions yet to be received at the systems level at the state. And we're really honored to be the ones who have applied on behalf of the state. And we have a lot of incredible partners that we're working with to accomplish the goals that we're going to talk about in the grant today.
So why has it traditionally been hard for Nevada to access federal dollars?
It's been difficult for Nevada to access federal dollars for a variety of reasons. You know, I think in some ways, it's some of the same reasons for why youth homelessness has grown a lot in Nevada and why our social services systems here have struggled a bit to keep up with the rising demand for these services and the need for these services. Because Nevada has had historic population growth over the past 30 years or so, right? We've grown really, really, really fast as a state. And it's just challenging when you grow that quickly to keep up your infrastructure, right? And to grow your social services, your infrastructure, to be able to meet that very, very quickly growing demand as your city grows and matures and has, you know, the needs of a big city, starting from a much smaller type of town in a lot of ways. There's so much that needs to be done to catch up with that, right? And so that's one of the reasons why youth homelessness is such a major problem here, right, is because it's just difficult for social services to catch up fast enough. And similarly, it's very difficult for our infrastructure to catch up to be able to respond to these very complex, competitive federal grant applications. And so Nevada, as kind of a younger state that's grown so quickly and so exponentially, to be able to catch up, that's been a bit of a challenge for us. And you know, also being a very transient state, right, a lot of the overwhelming majority of people who live in Nevada were not born here. That also, just as it relates to young people not necessarily having local support systems to fall back on, kind of a similar thing when it comes to the pool of people applying for grants and whatnot, that a lot of people kind of move in and out of the state. And that can make it difficult to have that group of people who can really develop the specialty in applying for grants for Nevada and in Nevada and being able to accomplish that.
So Arash, when you're talking about the grant being designed to address the system of youth homelessness, what does that look like in terms of how NPHY will use the funds?
Yeah, great question. And thank you. So how this relates is that the system is something that we all contribute here locally. Local government contributes to it, donors contribute to it, nonprofits are part of the system. But also things like juvenile justice are part of the system. Things like the school district are part of the system. Things like foster care are also part of the system. So these are all the systems that young people experiencing homelessness could interact with. And to them, they don't know the difference between all of these things. But the school district has its own policies. Local government has its own policies. Nonprofits are bound by certain policies and procedures, either from funders or that they themselves derive. And all these things create what I would say a lack of consistency and a lack of coordination in the systems that youth are interacting with that lead to suboptimal or less efficient results. And we've actually done needs assessments where we've seen that our system is not serving young people equally or optimally. One, our system cannot serve just the sheer demand that it has overall, but the system is not doing a particularly great job of serving BIPOC youth, for example. So youth that are Black or other youth of color in our system actually have less successful experience coming out of the system. And what this all speaks to is the fact that we as communities, we as the entire state, have to come together and really take a look at these systems, how they're interacting. And then most importantly, what we want to do with this grant is bring youth to the table. There are a lot of adults, there's a lot of policymakers, there's a lot of funders, and we're all guessing and thinking about what is the best solution for young people. But young people need to be at the table. They need to be empowered to be part of recommending or criticizing what is working well or what is not working well in the system and giving us ideas about what we can do. So that is one part of the grant, is how we can uplift youth voice throughout the state, creating more venues for them to actually talk, creating more venues where they feel empowered and appropriately educated so they can actually impact policy, so they can actually impact systems and tell us how to make it work better. That way we, as a collective of communities throughout the state, can respond to these really important recommendations that they tell us and that we also derive with them, that we as a state can also respond, put that all together, and start developing a robust statewide plan that incorporates their voice and that has a system level focus on how we can make the entire systems that youth interact with work better. And that includes the homelessness system and other related systems I mentioned earlier, like juvenile justice, education, and that's both K through 12 and higher education, et cetera.
This grant will really expand on our systems level work and will improve direct services offered throughout the state by the various systems that interact with one another and with young people experiencing homelessness. And exactly like Arash said, one of the things that's really amazing that this grant is going to allow us to do is to really uplift youth voice throughout the state, right? So it's going to let us provide training for young people, education for young people, leadership development opportunities for young people to grow their self-esteem, allow them to explore career opportunities, interests, public speaking, you know, learn amazing marketable skills as well that they'll be able to use for employment, et cetera, but be able to really create structures and opportunities for them to bring their voices, their opinions, and their feedback to the table and create avenues where those recommendations and that feedback must be heard and must be considered and incorporated into planning processes, resource allocation, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So what this grant is going to allow us to do is to build and strengthen youth action boards throughout Nevada. So that includes creating, growing and strengthening a youth action board in Southern Nevada. That includes creating, getting off the ground, growing and strengthening a youth action board in Northern Nevada. And it also includes, for the first time ever, creating a youth action board that will exist throughout the entire state. And what these boards do is they're a collection of young people who meet on a regular basis and are able to provide feedback, provide their opinions, provide all kinds of input into the creation of systems, into helping jurisdictions, local government bodies, local governing boards of other types to be able to make decisions on what to prioritize, how to allocate resources, et cetera, and just create opportunities for youth voice to be heard and for young people to serve as leaders in building and creating the systems that are ultimately serving them. So this will enable us to do all of that, which is excellent. And then when we build up these opportunities for young people to get their voices heard, that's going to immediately lead into the creation of this statewide plan to end youth homelessness, just like Arash mentioned. So this statewide movement youth action board will be able to then use these skills and all of the growth that they've accomplished through these trainings, through creation of their structure, through creation of making sure that their meetings and their structure is accessible to all different kinds of diverse youth, that they will then be able to really help drive and lead this process to create a comprehensive plan to attack and end youth homelessness throughout Nevada from every corner of our state.
So how does this project compare to your movement to end youth homelessness, which has been happening for a few years now?
Yeah, another great question, Heather. And actually, this is a direct expansion of our movement work. And in fact, the entire application to the federal government was really talking about the movement work. So what you're seeing is this award is really a testament to the movement working and being really highly effective. When we started the movement, we wanted to create a brighter spotlight on the issue of youth homelessness and start trying to bring people together in our community just to talk about what's working well and what's not and how we can educate ourselves more. And that led to the creation of a Southern Nevada plan that incorporated youth voice and over 40 partners, et cetera. But then after that, we realized that we need to go statewide. And last year, we had our first statewide summit where we learned all about what's going on in different corners of our state and from different type of members of our state too. So it's not just Southern Nevada, it's our rural communities, it's our tribal communities, it's our frontier communities as well. And homelessness looks different there as well. So this grant is really a furtherance of all of our movement work. And we apply to the federal government specifically with two goals. One is to uplift youth voice because we need the consumers of all these systems to tell us what's working, what's not, what's missing, what can we do do better? What are we doing wrong, et cetera? And then immediately, as Melissa said, mobilize into action using that input and using what we've learned and using needs assessments that we've commissioned in the past and that we're currently working on with the Division of Welfare and Social Services and others, putting all that together to then fund the creation of the first ever statewide dedicated plan to ending youth homelessness for Nevada. And that is exactly what we applied. And the federal government, having many wonderful applications, I think definitely saw the value in the movement because it is an undeniable way of showing that the communities in Nevada have come together so much more over the last 7 years in their dedication and in their pursuit to getting ahead of this issue in our state once and for all. And we are on the brink of being able to accomplish that. And I think that this grant is not only a testament to the movement's work, but it's an opportunity for the movement to double down and further its work. And we're extremely excited for the 2+ year runway that this grant gives us to really expand our movement work. So the grant is highly related to our movement work because it's a furtherance of our movement work, Heather.
And something else that's really exciting about this too is Arash mentioned that, you know, this is the first time that HUD, the federal government, has offered a grant of this type, right? HUD traditionally really focuses on direct services, especially funding housing and emergency shelter and programs of that type. And, you know, MPHY launched the movement to end youth homelessness in 2017, and we've been having annual summits since then. We've been doing statewide planning work that we've discussed. We've been working with young people to pass state laws, to break down barriers, to ensure that they can exit homelessness sustainably, and doing a lot of that systems coordination, right? Coordinating between all of the related systems, like Arash has mentioned, like child welfare and education and juvenile justice with our larger homelessness services system, et cetera. And so MPHY has been leading the movement and this systems level work since 2017, because we've really looked and said, the only way that we are going to end homelessness for young people in Nevada, or at least make homelessness for Nevada much more manageable in a way where young people know how to access resources immediately, they're able to receive the resources that they need to sustainably and successfully exit homelessness for good, et cetera, that the only way we can do that is by engaging in this type of systems level work and systems level coordination. So it's also really amazing to see HUD now, you know, 8+ years later, recognizing that actually this work is very sorely needed, right? And for the federal government to come in and say, hey, you know, we traditionally only fund services, but we now see the value and the need for this systems level work, and for them to, you know, devote $50 million plus nationwide to this type of work, I think really just kind of emphasizes the importance of things like the movement. And MPHY is really proud to be, you know, engaging that and leading that work throughout our state.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So what else about this Youth Homelessness System Improvement Grant or homeless youth issues in Nevada in general do our listeners need to know?
Well, our listeners need to know, Heather, that youth homelessness is a really complex ordeal for our community, right? Because if we don't do something about youth homelessness, it feeds right into the adult homelessness system. It feeds right into a lot of other issues that drain our medical system, that don't positively contribute to our tax base, that reduce the amount of civic engagement and voting in our community and diminish the power of our labor workforce and other things as well. So investing in youth homelessness is really, not to sound cliche, but it's really investing in the future of our community, because these young people ripple through the community in so many different ways. And I hope our listeners can appreciate that there are many people on the ground, including some of our listeners, that are donating or advocating or working with organizations that work with young people. And that this is a long-term battle, but it's a battle that we can win. And we are finally getting to explore and touch on some of the things that matter most critically for young people. So it's a combination of two things. It's having enough beds so young people don't have to turn to the streets when bad things happen to them. Because to remind our listeners again, one more time, youth homelessness is really unique because it happens suddenly, unpredictably. Young people don't know when it's going to knock on their door or what decisions others have made that could impact them. So it's a combination of making sure that we have enough beds so young people don't have to turn to the streets, but it's also evaluating our system and making sure, you know, just to call the system a hospital for a second, is this hospital doing a great job? Could it be doing a better job? How could it be providing better patient care? How could it be more preventative for its patients? That way they don't have to be in the hospital as long or ever come back again. And how can the hospital equitably serve all the people that need access to the hospitals throughout our state that are helping with homelessness in this example. And that is exactly what we're exploring and figuring out what to do. And the outcome of this work benefits our entire state. It reduces burdens on public services. It reduces burdens on businesses that have to deal with the chronicity of homelessness, et cetera. So this is a really wonderful opportunity to get ahead and actually make a generational impact in the state of Nevada. And what Melissa was talking about earlier, it's true that Nevada has grown from dust, you know, since 1905, but really over the last 7 years, it has come from a very tiny, dusty town to evolve into a major metropolitan area. And it's happened really fast. And we need to catch up. And I think that we're on the verge of finally catching up for young people. And our goal is to make sure that young people have the same opportunities to chase their futures and invest in our communities throughout Nevada as some of the rest of us do. And that's what I think that we can do. And the community is our lifeline for that work. They support our work. They fuel our work. They make our organizations, and not just MPHY. We're talking about other organizations. We're talking about even local government, because taxpayers are the ones that fund these services. So it's all of our listeners that are helping make these things happen. And I want our listeners to know that we hear a lot about homelessness, but we are on the verge, at least when it comes to youth homelessness, of really making a huge impact in the state of Nevada. And we're so excited. And we want to thank all your listeners for being part of that momentum with us.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So where can people go for more information about NPHY and your work in the community, or even get involved in helping out the organization?
Yeah, absolutely. So listeners can visit our website. So that's nphy.org or nphy.org. They can also look us up on, we have very active social medias, Instagram, Facebook, to follow kind of our news and what we have going on. Listeners are also always welcome to give us a call. Our phone number here is 702-383-1332. And they can give us a call and reach out to us about volunteer opportunities. We have all different kinds of ways to make an impact, actually go out in the community and meet young people where they are and meet their immediate needs, to providing food and clothing and hygiene supplies, and actually make connections, build rapport, build trust with young people, share information about our services so they know how to access our services and who to call when they do or if they do find themselves in a crisis situation. Listeners could also reach out to us by sending us an email. They could email us at volunteer@nphy.org about volunteering, or they can also reach out to us at info@nphy.org with any ideas, questions, suggestions, or just ways to get involved. But definitely checking out our website. We have all kinds of information on there on how to donate, how to advocate, how to donate in-kind items like clothes or hygiene supplies we're always in need of, or just how to get involved in our advocacy work and spread the word.
And Heather, I would add to all the listeners that, you know, Melissa and I have been working on this issue and at this agency for over 13 years. And it amazes us still that what our volunteers or what people that call us to learn more about the issue of youth homelessness, what they end up bringing to the table. And I want to encourage our listeners that no idea is too big or too small. We at NPHY, we use everything from notepads that a young person didn't need to use to finish their school year. We use all kinds of supplies that maybe other people think are not valuable, but for us, hygiene and soap and all these things are very valuable. But more than that, everyone has a skill set that our young people need to learn. Remember, listeners, that our young people have experienced homelessness during a critical point of their life where no one is teaching them how to cook. No one is mentoring them on the next steps of life, how to be an adult, et cetera. So there's tons of opportunities that every one of us knows someone else, and the whole Kevin Bacon 5 degrees of separation. We, among all of us on this listening to the show, know the right people to get involved in this. So don't be afraid to reach out and get involved, because we'll find a way to ensure that you are part of the movement to end youth homelessness in the state of Nevada.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Okay, so once again, the website is nphy.org. That stands for Nevada Partnership for Homeless Youth, nphy.org. You can also give them a call, 702-383-1332. 702-383-1332. If you want to find out more information, you can email them info@nphy.org. And if you'd like to be a volunteer, volunteer@nphy.org is the email for that. volunteer@nphy.org. And we've been speaking today with Arash Ghafouri. He's the CEO, and also Melissa Jacobowitz. She's the Chief of Development and Strategy for NPHY. And Arash and Melissa, I want to thank you both so much for being here. You've given us so much information about the state of youth homelessness in the state of Nevada, and also the amazing work that you're doing now, what this new federal grant from HUD is going to allow you to do more, and how important it is for the community to support your work. So it's been fantastic talking to you. I'm so happy that you got this new grant, and thank you so much for sharing with us today.
Thank you, Heather. It's a pleasure. And thank you to you for the wonderful work you do of informing our community about what's going on through your public affairs show. And thank you for providing us the format to discuss this important accomplishment and this opportunity.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Heather. We really appreciate it.
After I lost my mom, I lost my way. Then I found youth advocate programs, YAP.
YAP gives communities alternatives to residential care, youth incarceration, and neighborhood violence. Others talk social change. We make it happen. Learn more at yapinc.org.
I'm Heather Vale, and this is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Joining me is Cindy Long, Food and Nutrition Service Administrator for the U.S. Department of Agriculture, or USDA. To help tackle childhood hunger during the summer months, the USDA has launched their new SUN programs, which is short for Summer Nutrition Programs. Cindy, thank you so much for being here today.
It's a pleasure to be here, Heather.
So what is the USDA?
The USDA is the Department of Agriculture, and I'm specifically with the Food and Nutrition Service, and we operate all of the nutrition assistance programs in the United States.
How many children in Nevada suffer from food insecurity?
Well, what I can tell you is on an average day in Nevada, about 350,000 kids eat a school lunch. Many of those receive school breakfast, and they do that at a free or reduced price. So those are 350,000 kids who are in need of nutrition support.
Okay. Tell us about the new USDA Summer Nutrition Programs, or SUN programs.
So we have had a program for a while now that allows kids to receive meals when they come together in summer programs. So maybe something at a rec center or a summer school or church camp, kids come together and eat meals. But that's only ever been able to reach about 1 in 6 of the kids who get meals at school. So now we have two great new tools within the SUN programs. One is for rural areas where kids can, instead of having to come together every day, which can be challenging due to transportation and schedules, et cetera, families can either pick up meals or have meals delivered. And the third really exciting new part of the SUN program is something called SUN Bucks, which is going to be providing families of kids who receive free or reduced price meals with a card that they can use to buy grocery benefits. That card will be worth $120 per child for the summer.
Nice. Okay. So how would a child become eligible for the SUN program?
Well, any child that is eligible to receive a free or reduced price meal during the school year is eligible. And one of the great things about the SUN Bucks program is that many kids will automatically receive benefits if their families are currently on other programs like SNAP or TANF or other programs in the state. And there are other families who will still be eligible, and they'll be able to apply through a simple application that the state will make available.
Now, how are SUN programs different from other nutrition support initiatives for kids?
Well, most of the nutrition support that folks might be familiar with, like school meals, are based on this idea of kids coming together and somebody providing them meals. So these new pieces of the program, the meal delivery, the meal pickup, and especially the summer EBT card, that's really a new way to provide benefits that are specifically targeted at replacing the meals that kids receive at school. So if you go to fns.usda.gov/summer, you'll find a range of resources. Now, one of those resources that I think is particularly useful is called our Site Finder, and it allows folks to go in and type in their location, maybe their zip code, and we'll be able to show where there are sites available, both for SUN meals, where kids eat together, as well as SUN meals to go.
Perfect. So once again, that website, fns.usda.gov/summer. FNS stands for Food and Nutrition Service, and then USDA.gov Sun.org/summer. And there you'll be able to find out all about the new Sun programs, including Sun Meals to Go and the program Sun Bucks, which you can take the money to the grocery store. And we've been speaking today with Cindy Long. She's the Food and Nutrition Service Administrator for the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And Cindy, it's been great finding out more about this new program and how it can benefit residents. So thank you so much for your time today.
And thank you for having me, Heather.
When a student lacks basic needs like food, clothing, and learning materials, attending school can be a challenge.
And that can make it impossible to thrive.
At Communities in Schools, we address this issue by ensuring that students have everything they need to re-engage in learning,
access to technology and school supplies,
and even emotional support.
By bringing communities of support to students, we're achieving equitable learning conditions.
And that's what Communities in Schools is all about.
Learn more at communitiesinschools.org.
I'm Heather Vail, and this is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Joining me is Jean Sachs, CEO of Living Beyond Breast Cancer, and metastatic breast cancer patient advocate Betty Sanchez. Thank you both for being here today.
Thank you for having us.
Jean, what is Living Beyond Breast Cancer?
So Living Beyond Breast Cancer is a national nonprofit, and our mission is to connect people impacted by breast cancer with trusted information and a community of support. So no matter what stage you're diagnosed with, we're a place you can come to get your questions answered and find community.
Okay. Now, what exactly is metastatic breast cancer?
Sure. So metastatic breast cancer is breast cancer that has spread beyond the breast, typically into a vital organ. And it is then considered stage 4. And as of now, it's considered an incurable disease, although many people can live well, but they'll be in treatment for the rest of their lives.
How common is metastatic breast cancer among breast cancer patients?
You know, we don't have perfect statistics, but they say about 30% of women who are diagnosed with early stage breast cancer will at some point become metastatic.
Wow.
Yeah. And it can happen, you know, years later.
So, Betty, what has your personal journey with metastatic breast cancer been like?
Oh, it was rough. I'm an 8-year survivor, 8-year metastatic breast cancer survivor. I was diagnosed with inflammatory breast cancer at first, which went undetected as an insect bite. And it was my mother and daughter who insisted I get a second opinion. And I was lucky and fortunate that my healthcare team did a subtype. I hadn't had biomarker testing yet. It's something that I just recently learned about, but I will be having it. So my initial biopsy subtype showed that it was HER2 positive, which responded well to a treatment plan that was less toxic and more targeted. And I think that has helped me survive into 8 years. But it was hard in the first few years, and I just feel blessed that I'm here now.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So you mentioned biomarker testing. What exactly is biomarker testing?
So biomarker testing is looking more closely at the tumor, the cancer itself, and it can be done with a tissue sample or a liquid biopsy, which is blood. And it shows changes, proteins, genes, ways that the cancer is evolving, potentially new mutations. And with this kind of detailed information, there can be new treatments that, again, are going to be more targeted and more effective that we wouldn't have known about if the biomarker testing hadn't been done.
What might some of those new treatments look like?
So there are treatments that, when I say targeted, they'll sort of treat that exact mutation that is driving the cancer. So whether it's based on hormones or over gene expression, proteins, I mean, it's complicated science, but what we're learning is as the cancer becomes resistant, other mutations may be happening and there might be a new treatment that will be more effective, but you will only know about it if you ask your doctor about biomarker testing.
I'd just like to add on to that. Initially, before I knew or before the doctors knew what subtype I had, they gave me a type of treatment that basically kills most cells. But with these targeted treatments, it now kills that specific type of cancer versus all the cells. And so that's why it's really important to have these biomarker tests.
Yeah, that sounds very promising.
Yeah, less side effects.
Yeah, fantastic. So what is the No One Missed campaign?
So the No One Missed campaign is a campaign to specifically raise awareness for those diagnosed with metastatic breast cancer to ask their doctor about biomarker testing and to find out if they've had it, and if not, why or why not, and if it might be appropriate for you. Because a lot of people, you know, again, this isn't brand new, but it is relatively new, and we know that many metastatic patients are not being offered it. So we really want patients to ask their doctor and find out.
So then what questions should patients ask their doctors about biomarker testing?
It's really important that everybody knows this campaign right now is specifically targeting those diagnosed with metastatic breast cancer. So remember, those diagnosed with early stage, which is a much bigger group, biomarker testing isn't playing that big of a role yet. But if you're diagnosed with metastatic breast cancer, again, ask your doctor. If you have had it, find out what they learned. They might not have learned anything new. But then ask if your cancer progresses, that's another opportunity to say, now would it make sense to have biomarker testing? Because often you need to repeat the test at every progression. And what you also want to learn is, what are they learning from this biomarker testing? And is there a new treatment that might be effective for them? So that's, we really want to start good dialogues with your medical oncologist.
Okay. Betty, what advice would you have for patients going through the metastatic breast cancer journey as you have?
I'm just going to repeat what Jean said. It's very important to get biomarker testing during your journey, because the cancer could have changed. And if it has changed, then there might be a better treatment for you out there. And that's going to create less side effects. I mean, side effects are daunting. It can create fatigue, hair loss, of course, which is a common occurrence. But with targeted treatment, it might lessen that fatigue. It might lessen the prospect of hair loss. I mean, there's so many ways to improve your quality of life with targeted treatment. So it's important, so important to get biomarker testing. I can't emphasize enough of what Jean is saying. Biomarker testing is key to survival and to quality of life.
Yeah. So Jean, where can listeners go if they want more information about metastatic breast cancer, the Living Beyond Breast Cancer organization, and specifically the No One Missed campaign?
Of course. So you can find Living Beyond Breast Cancer at lbbc.org. You can find information about the No One Missed campaign at noonemissed.org/breastcancer. You can also follow us on social media channels. So many, many ways to easily find more information.
Fantastic. Okay, so once again, lbbc.org is the website for Living Beyond Breast Cancer, lbbc.org. And the No One Missed campaign, encouraging patients of metastatic breast cancer to ask those questions about biomarker testing. That campaign, noonemissed.org/breastcancer. noonemissed.org/breastcancer. And we've been speaking today with Jean Sachs. She's the CEO of Living Beyond Breast Cancer, and also metastatic breast cancer patient advocate Betty Sanchez, who has been living with metastatic breast cancer for almost a decade now. I want to thank both of you for being here today. Jean, for providing more information and letting patients know what they can ask, what they can experience, what they can look forward to. And Betty, for sharing your personal journey and your story with us, along with your advice that you've learned along the way. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
If you're a woman, talk to your doctor by age 25 about your risk of getting breast cancer. More women under 40 are getting breast cancer, and these cancers are often more deadly. The American College of Radiology recommends you ask your doctor if you should get a mammogram before age 40, need other tests like an MRI with your yearly mammogram, or if at high risk should be checked more than once a year. For more information, visit mammographysaveslives.org.
From Odyssey, in partnership with the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, this is I'm Listening, Talk Away the Dark, a limited series. Today, Dr. Maria Boynton from our Atlanta, Georgia properties
hosts an intimate conversation on mental health and suicide prevention in Black, Brown, and all communities of color during Minority Mental Health Awareness Month. Maria is joined by American Foundation for Suicide Prevention expert Victor Armstrong and Sarah Dixon Hackey, Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Liaison for Clay County Public Health. Now, here's Dr. Maria Boynton.
Vic and Sarah, welcome. So Vic, with it being Minority Mental Health Month, when we talk about the African-American church, mental health from your purview, how is it received? How is it addressed?
I think it's changing some now. We're starting to see some progress, but there's still a long way to go. I grew up in a community where both my Black community and my faith-based community really kind of ingrained in me that suicide and mental health challenges were not things that impacted my community. And that if they did impact my community, as a person of faith, my remedy should be more faith, that I should be able to pray about it, that I should be able to talk to God about it. But there was never a conversation about talk with mental health professionals. I think one of the things that I've come to learn later, though, now that I am in this space, is that while there was a narrative within my community that was reinforced by my community about mental health and suicide not being things that impacted us, there was also a reinforcement of that message coming from outside the community by the simple fact that the organizations that specialized in this field, the organizations that specialized in suicide prevention, the organizations that specialized in mental health, were not reaching into my community saying, no, this is about you. We want to provide resources that are relevant to your community. And so what that tended to do was that it reinforced that my message must be correct. My narrative must be correct. And my narrative was a narrative that really was based on misinformation or lack of information. And so part of what I've learned since then, too, is that if we want to break a lot of that stigma, institutions like faith-based organizations in Black and Brown communities can be very instrumental in doing that. And I think really have a responsibility because of the relationship to the community to help us to really fix a lot of those challenges, those historical challenges that our communities have faced.
And Sarah, in your community, can you share with us what the perceptions are and how mental health is addressed in your community? What's been your experience?
You know, I think there's a couple different experiences I would look at. One from, I think, from my time growing up, certainly, which was in a small town in the Midwest. It was really, I think perspective or overall experience of having in a lot of ways, a racial minority kind of perspective, because I lived and was raised by a white family. And so a lot of their values or all their values were really passed on to me. And much of that was based around the church. And I think just our community in general is a small town. But I think because of that, we really live by this principle of not really talking about our issues, not really addressing or acknowledging those deeper emotional, I think, kind of themes. And that really translated into how I saw mental health, even with my own personal struggles. And I think because of that, it really shaped how I address things until much later in life. So I think for me personally, a lot of my values came from this idea of keeping everything, to kind of actually pull from an AFSB concept, which is keeping things in the dark, very much, keeping it to yourself and knowing that we don't deal with those things in public. Those are private behind the closed doors, and you certainly don't talk about them with anyone else.
Sarah, being Asian, as I'm looking at you now, being a member of the Asian community, and you say that you were raised by a white couple, have you been able to see a differential between how the Asian community views mental health issues versus that of the Caucasian community? Is there a difference? And how have you been able to bridge that gap?
That's a really complicated question and a good one, to be honest with you. To be honest, I didn't for a long time, and I still am struggling with that, finding, I think, a sense of what the Asian community's perspective is, because I was so isolated in my own experience. I can literally count on one hand the number of minorities, I think, that I was raised around in my young time. And so you know, I truly believe that it wasn't until I hit my 30s that I saw this acknowledgement of even wanting to look outside of the majority, because I spent so much time really wanting to be part of the larger majority, wanting to be part of and fall into that group. So I didn't pay attention for a long time. But I think that when I look now through the work that I do with public health, some of the members of the Asian community, I know certainly, you know, and it really depends on what part of, you know, Asia you're really talking about. But there are parts of the world, quite frankly, that I would say are, you know, a few decades behind in terms of our openness, right? We look at the U.S. as making a lot of progress, as we have in this openness of conversation and using the phrases mental health. And I think we have to be mindful of the fact that other communities, including those that are Asian, are not at that same point.
We know the research, we know the statistics that mental health can be especially stigmatized among minority communities. Vic, in your experience, how has that changed? And is it getting better? I guess my question should be.
I think it is getting better, partly because we are seeing more of a willingness for I think high-profile individuals to talk about their mental health challenges. We're seeing more celebrities, more athletes. We're also, I think, being more thoughtful about how we reach different communities. For example, we have a partnership at AFSP with Megan Thee Stallion, because we know that she reaches young people. And so it's really thinking about those kinds of things and how we reach the communities that way. I think the other thing, too, is that we're also thinking differently about who are the influencers in communities, who already has that trusted relationship with the community, and we're doing a better job of coming alongside those organizations, institutions, faith-based community being one of those. One of the programs we have at FSP is Soul Shop for Black Churches. It's teaching faith leaders in the Black community how to talk about suicide with their congregants. And so that helps to eliminate a lot of the stigma, because a lot of the stigma has been perpetrated by the faith-based community. A lot of the stigma has been perpetrated by this notion that athletes are supposed to be stoic and strong and not show vulnerability, that men in general are not supposed to show vulnerability. And so I think the more that we can demonstrate that there's strength in vulnerability, we start to see that stigma come down some. Now, the flip side of that, though, is while we are seeing the stigma come down, we are seeing an uptick in the rate of suicide in Black and brown communities. So we still have to be very proactive in thinking about and thinking differently about how we reach communities to address the stigma that still does exist on many levels.
Sarah, what have you found among those struggling with suicidal thoughts or behaviors? What have you found to be the biggest factor? Is it being ashamed to ask for help, or what have you found?
Well, I mean, that's I think always kind of a complex question. I always kind of defer to the fact that certainly suicide is extremely complex. There's a lot of factors of what prevent people from speaking out. But certainly I think stigma is a common thread that I see again and again. I think the last time we had kind of chatted one other time, so, and I think Vic said this so well, that a lot of times we don't have the vocabulary. And I think about it in the sense that, you look at a young person, and I mean, really young, and you think about kids who point to something and they call it the wrong thing, right? You know, I have nieces and nephews, and I remember when they were kind of growing up, and they would point at something and call it something different, but you knew what they were talking about, but they just couldn't express themselves, and that frustration eventually would kind of defer into them not really talking about that or just going on to something else. And I think sometimes that lack of ability to have that vocabulary, and then the audience that's willing to sit with them. Because I think, again, one of the things that I see a lot of times when I do my mental health first aid trainings is that we are well-versed in being participants in conversations and sometimes dominating those discussions. But we're not well-versed in being observers and sounding boards. words. And I think that oftentimes, especially now, is something where we lack that education and that practice. And so I think knowing that, you know, maybe that person that you're with, you're afraid they're going to judge you, that they aren't going to receive what you have to say, or they're going to try and fix it for you, right? Any of those three things oftentimes prevents us from speaking out.
You know, and I would add to that too, Maria, because I think Sarah unpacked a lot of really important points there. And when we think about kids, I think one of the challenges that we have, and one of the things that we can do differently, is that we start out early on teaching kids how to identify basic emotions. We teach them how to identify when you're happy, when you're sad, when you're angry. We don't teach them how to identify when you're lonely, how to identify when you're vulnerable, how to identify those things that can, if left unchecked, can lead to mental health challenges. And I think that's part of what we have to recognize, because as Sarah pointed out, suicide, it really is a complex issue. And I point out to people all the time that suicide itself is not a disease. It is the worst possible outcome of a lot of very complex things, often including mental health challenges. And if that's the case, that means that there are ways that we can treat people before they get to that point of suicidality if we have the resources in place to address people at their point of need in the communities people live, work, play, and pray. And I think that's part of our challenge, is recognizing those things that can lead a person to suicidality and being able to address those things more effectively before they reach that point.
Vic, of course, we talk about the stigma, but then we, in our previous conversations, we talked about how some families are able to deal with the mental illness, not necessarily from the critical standpoint, but more so from the accepting standpoint. And the community understands that that family might have some issues, or someone in their home who has mental health issues, not necessarily every single day, but there might be outbursts, things of that nature. How have you found the community to be in terms of those situations where families don't necessarily have the extreme outward signs of mental health, but more of a subdued presentation? What have you found?
I think that's an interesting point, because part of what I've seen is that communities and families have a willingness to take care of their own. And I think in part, some of the way that we have socialized the approach to mental health and mental health challenges in, not just in America, but I think globally, really has done some damage. Because I think what we've done is, I think we've, a lot of the stigma that's attached to mental health challenges has come from the way that we talk about it and the way that we address it outside of communities. I think a lot of what has happened over time, as I think back to my childhood growing up, I can identify people that I know, even family members of mine, that had mental health challenges. But there were people that took care of them. They did not live in hospitals. They did not live in institutions. They lived at home with family members, surrounded by people who loved them and cared about them. Now, was it the most clinically therapeutic environment? Probably not. But they had social connection. And I think that's one of the pieces that communities and families naturally provide that oftentimes we miss. And so I think part of what we have to think about is, how do we look at those things that are, that families and communities are doing at the community level, that are working to keep people living in the community, and how do we create more of those things? What often happens is that we provide resources that really are about how we can draw down our funds, about how we can further our brand, and it's not always focused on the specific needs of communities. If we want to know how to better serve communities and how to allow communities to better serve themselves and serve family members, all we have to do is ask them. And so I think that's part of what we have to think differently about going forward as systems, is how do we tap into communities, look at things that are working at the community level, look at how communities are already taking care of their own, and then how do we join and come alongside those things, as opposed to creating something in a laboratory and then trying to force it on communities, because there are some lessons to be learned in how communities take care of each other.
My thanks to Vic Armstrong from the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention and Sarah Dixon Hackey, Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Liaison for Clay County Public Health, for joining me today for this vital conversation. For more information on how you can start the conversation in in your community, please visit afsp.org. And if at any time you or someone you know is in crisis and needs to talk with someone right away, please call or text 988. I'm Dr. Maria Boynton, and this is I'm Listening.
To find out more about Talk Away the Dark, please visit afsp.org. And if you or someone you know is in crisis, please call or text 988. For the full show and more stories like this one, download the I'm Listening podcast on the Odyssey app or visit imlistening.org.
Today, 1 in 5 Americans experience emotional and mental health challenges, but many of us don't know how to ask for help.
At the American Psychiatric Association Foundation, we work every day to eliminate stigma and advance mental health. Visit mentallyhealthynation.org to learn more.
I'm Heather Vail with the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show, and this is your community events calendar for nonprofit initiatives and charity events around the Valley. Monday's Dark with Mark Chinook is a bi-monthly musical fundraising party at The Space, with each event raising $10,000 for a specific charity in 90 minutes. Upcoming shows include this Monday, July 15th at 8 p.m. benefiting the Little Miss Hannah Foundation, and Monday, August 5th at 8 p.m. benefiting the Foster Friday Foundation. Get tickets or find out more details at mondaysdark.com. That's mondaysdark.com. The Las Vegas Clark County Library District is holding their annual Free Summer Challenge Reading and Activities Program through July 31st. This year's theme is all about our planet's beautiful oceans, and they have plenty of activities and prizes still up for grabs. Find out more or get started at thelibrarydistrict.org/summerchallenge. That's thelibrarydistrict.org/summerchallenge. And the Las Vegas Rescue Mission is holding their annual Bottled Water Drive through August 31st. During the heat of summer, water is crucial for those experiencing homelessness. You can drop off bottled water donations at the Las Vegas Rescue Mission security gate 24/7. To make larger donations or organize a drive, contact Director of Development Heather Williams at 702-320-2089. 702-320-2089. 2089, or find out more at vegasrescue.org. That's vegasrescue.org.